All right, everybody, welcome back to the weekday interview show this week. Our guest is Marie Coco. Her columns for Newsday are syndicated in newspapers around the country and have won her awards from the Associated Press, the Newswomen's Club of New York, and New York Newspapers Guild, the New York State Publishers Association, and the New York Press Club. A veteran reporter, she has broken major stories about the secret detention of Americans during World War II and about the national government being the country's single biggest polluter. Welcome to the show, Mrs. Coco.
Thank you.
What caught my attention was your column from, I think, the beginning of August about what you called a rear guard action by the White House to delay and obstruct the September 11th commission investigating the attacks. What do you mean by a rear guard action?
Well, it's rear guard because it's their last effort, really, to keep a full investigation of that day from ever occurring. When the attacks occurred, in the immediate aftermath of those attacks, the family members and several members of Congress, including Senator McCain, wanted very much to have a comprehensive investigation of how the attack had occurred. It's very rare in Washington that you would have an event of that magnitude and not have anyone take a look at it, find out what contributed to it, find out what can be done better the next time, and so forth. And initially, the White House said, no, we can't have any investigation of this because merely investigating September 11th would have repercussions for national security. So first, the White House politically worked on Capitol Hill to block the creation of the commission at all. And almost a year passed. In fact, I think a year did pass from the time of the attack until the time the legislation finally was passed, setting up an independent commission with appointees from both the White House and Capitol Hill to look at this. Once the commission itself was established, the White House also, by the way, when the legislation was being drafted, did everything it could to water down the power of the commission. For example, it weighed in very heavily. It did not want this commission to have the power of subpoena. And that becomes important because, as you heard the president just the other day at his news conference, Tom Kaine, who is the former Republican governor of New Jersey, raised the specter publicly for the first time of actually issuing a subpoena to the White House. Well, when this commission was being formed, when the legislation empowering the commission was being written, the White House fought vigorously against giving it the right to subpoena documents. It failed. It managed to get an arrangement whereby any vote for a subpoena on the commission has to be bipartisan. So it made every effort for about a year simply to thwart this commission from coming into existence. Then fast forward to this summer, which you made reference to in my first column on the subject, and Tom Kaine, along with Lee Hamilton, former Democratic member of Congress from Indiana, held their first, what they called their interim briefing. And what it really was an accusatory press conference where they came right out and said that they were getting very little cooperation from most of the executive branch agencies from which they were seeking information. They singled out the Department of Justice. They singled out the Department of Defense. They didn't talk too much about the White House at that point in time, but they issued pretty much a broad indictment of the foot-dragging and the general lack of vigor with which these executive agencies were responding to the request for information. That was in July. Then they promised us, the press and the families who go, by the way, to all these briefings, they promised a further progress report in September. Well, September comes, and lo and behold, Tom Kaine tells us that miraculously enough, their public announcement in July, their public complaint about the foot dragging and lack of cooperation had resulted in a rather remarkable flood of documents from a number of agencies. But the caveat was the White House was not one of them. They were still negotiating with the White House over sensitive material. There was still lack of access to things this commission considers important for them to see. To sort of wrap things up here, first it took a year to create the commission. Then once the commission was empowered, it was given only a year to complete its work. This commission goes out of existence at the end of May. So the process of stalling, of not responding quickly enough to requests for documents, of not allowing certain people to be interviewed, not allowing government officials, who work, by the way, for you and me, even if they are some of them political appointees, not allowing them to be interviewed privately. They have minders with them. They have other officials from their agencies or their offices who sit in on these interviews, sort of watching over what they're saying, what questions are being asked, and what responses are given. This whole process of very, very niggardly, I would say, or maybe not that word, but very, very determined opposition almost to providing a free flow of information becomes important in light of the deadline. Because if they don't get the material that they need and they don't get it in a timely fashion, they're simply going to run out of time. They're not going to be able to follow the various investigative leads that normally turn up when you do these big document searches.
Well, all the people on the commission have the security clearance to see what...
Well, that right? You've gotten right to the heart of it. The issue right now with the White House is access to something called the President's Daily Brief. Now, we know that in August of 2001, we know a couple of things that have been established through press accounts as well as through the report of the Joint Congressional Committee that looked at intelligence failures leading up to September 11th. And one of the things we know that's been established is that in August of 2001, the president got a very detailed briefing about the terrorist threat assessment. And according to the congressional panel, this briefing included information so specific from the FBI. The FBI had responded to apparently what it believed was an increased indication of hijacking. In other words, some kind of indicators about hijacking activity had prompted the FBI to respond in some way, to check this out, to scope it out, so to speak. We know from the Joint Congressional Committee that at least that amount of information was in that daily brief that went to the president in August of 2001. We also know about the material that was included in a number of fragmentary accounts about the prospect of a catastrophic attack. It was clear that the FBI and other intelligence agencies had some kind of indication, we don't know what, some kind of indication that it might involve aircraft hijackings, etc. But this is what they're now squabbling over. The Bush White House refused to give this briefing paper to the congressional intelligence committees, even though they've got clearance as well. And even though, I might add, one thing the public doesn't really understand about this is no one is looking to publish these documents. And in fact, it's the White House that ultimately retains the power to reclassify and not allow to be published any information that it wants to keep classified. So the normal process would be for them to hand over the stuff to these commission members, all of whom have high level of security clearance, just as the Joint Intelligence Committee has a high level of clearance and a high level of security, let the investigators look at it, and then if they want to reclassify it, the power to do that rests with the president. Congress and the commission do not have the power to take a classified document and publish it for all the world to see. You may recall that when the Joint Committee issued its report over the summer, the Congressional Committee, there was a rather famous 28 pages that were blacked out. And we know that they had to deal with the Saudis, the Saudi government. What kind of information is in there about the Saudi government, I personally do not know. I have only heard rumors about it. But here's a very good example of investigative material that was given to that congressional inquiry that was used by panel in the course of conducting its investigation and issuing its report, but then the White House retained the power to reclassify it, and in fact it did. So Tom Kaine, has publicly said that he understands the classification power remains with the White House, but he wants to look at every piece of information he can to find out what happened, and then whatever final report is written will essentially write around it. And you don't have to, nobody is asking the president to just publish this briefing paper on the front page of the newspaper. What they're asking is for very seasoned men and women, all of whom have high-level clearances. I mean, some of the former Clinton administration, Jamie Gorelick, a former high-ranking member of the Justice Department under Clinton, a number of senators on there, John Layman, the former Republican Navy Secretary. These people all of them, every last one, have had exposure to very sensitive, very dangerous information at some other point in their public careers, and they're all trustworthy people. What's happening here is that there is something embarrassing in that daily brief, and the White House is determined that the public not know what it is.
That's funny. You mentioned the 28 pages about the Saudis. There were also
in the congressional report.
Yeah, mm-hmm. In the congressional report. And something else you wrote about was that there were 15 pages on access limitations, where even the congressional committee was having a real hard time getting these stuff.
That's quite correct. The focus when the report was first issued in July was on, you know, what's the missing link here? Where's all this missing information about the Saudis? But then when you actually look through the full report of the Joint Committee, what you discover is that they wrote a 15-page appendix detailing everything the Bush administration would not let them have. And among the things the administration tried to do was it tried to deny them access to everything about Zacharias Moussaoui, who is charged in Virginia. He's in Virginia right now in federal custody, charged as the so-called 20th hijacker. These members of Congress actually had to go to court twice to obtain information that the Justice Department was trying to block by claiming it was somehow pertinent to the Moussaoui case and would deny Mr. Moussaoui a fair trial if, in fact, it was turned over to the congressional committee. In fact, the judge ruled twice in favor of the committee. So that was one example of the lengths to which the administration was trying to go to block Congress from having information. Another piece of information that they blocked Congress from having was of this same president's daily brief that I just discussed, which now the commission is trying so hard to get, the August briefing paper. Another thing, by the way, that the Joint Committee was not allowed to see, or they were allowed to see it but not allowed to apparently get copies of it, is that apparently at some point in his tenure, President Clinton had asked the Pentagon to draw up a war plan in Afghanistan to take out the Al-Qaeda presence there, and there were a number of different plans drawn up, and when the congressional committee sought to get up, they're old now, I mean they're kind of a moot point, when the congressional committee sought access to these plans, the Pentagon also denied them access to even these old Clinton-era military planning scenarios. So there's been quite a lot of blocking going on.
Wasn't there something that just came out last week or 2 weeks ago about how Clinton had had Osama bin Laden right in the sights and had neglected to pull the trigger a few times?
I think what's been reported, well, there's been a couple of things reported. First of all, I was unaware until I read the congressional report that, in fact, he had asked the Pentagon to draw up what amounted to invasion plans. I was completely unaware of that. We do know that he had tried to pinpoint bin Laden's location through intelligence, and two different events, at least two that we know of, occurred. One was the failed missile that missed the target, or, you know, supposedly got to this camp, you know, they missed Osama by an hour or whatever it is they say. But there was another, at least one other case that's been reported where Clinton did want to strike in some way, and he was told there was no quote-unquote actionable intelligence. In other words, that the intelligence about the specific whereabouts of bin Laden was simply not good enough to launch an attack. So I don't know that we're ever going to know the full story about what was attempted, what wasn't attempted because the military objected What were these supposedly 13 different scenarios? I think that was the number mentioned in the Intelligence Committee report. 13 different scenarios for going after the Haven in Afghanistan. I'm not sure we're ever going to know what it was for two reasons. One is that in some cases, the current administration is literally connected to it. And also because there is probably material that is by law classified for, I think it's 25 years after a president leaves office. So there may be some that is still legitimately inaccessible because it is simply too sensitive. There is other stuff that was specifically denied, I know, to the Congressional Committee.
It makes me wonder whether the reason that there was such a focus on making it a bipartisan commission was not so that they would get to the truth, but so that everybody would be equally protected. And we probably
I think that you're quite right. I mean, usually, I hate to be cynical, but a lot of times that's precisely what bipartisan means. It's sort of Washington code for equal protection. It was interesting to me when I read the Congressional Committee report is that you can almost read the tension between the two parties as they were writing that report. You can read between the lines the Republican critique that Clinton was ineffectual, that he didn't do enough, that he tried to take supposedly just a law enforcement approach to this problem. On the other hand, you can also see Sandy Berger testified openly about what they saw as a growing threat, what they were trying to do about it, at what point it became apparent to them that it was the number one national security problem, and so forth. So as you read the congressional report, you can almost sort of hear this being played out on cable TV, you know, the back and forth between the parties. I think, though, that everyone in Washington believes that we do not have really good intelligence about the terrorist threat then or now. During the Clinton era, we knew the camps were there. We did not infiltrate them, apparently. We could not infiltrate them with real human intelligence sources. I don't know whether we're able to do that now. Of course, the camps have been dispersed, so some would argue that the threat has become even harder to keep track of and penetrate because it's not centrally located as much as it was before we attacked Afghanistan. So I think there are, bipartisan does in many cases mean political cover, but I have to put in a word of really real praise for Tom Kaine, the Republican appointed by the White House after, of course, it tried to get Henry Kissinger to chair this commission. Governor Kaine has been a very strong voice to get this out, to get the information out in the open, to let the commission do its job. Lee Hamilton is a gentlemanly sort. He's a veteran of the Iran-Contra Committee. He's worked on these big, politically touchy investigations before. And thus far, I have to tell you, I think that what you see, at least to outward appearances, is that Tom Kaine is very serious about doing a really good job. You know, Tom Kaine had personal, lifelong friends killed in those towers and neighbors, and he was the governor of New Jersey, and there were hundreds and hundreds of people from New Jersey who were killed in that attack. So I think he has a personal stake in this, as well as a reputation at stake as a straight shooter who tries to do the right thing. It's not that he's totally an apolitical creature, but so far, and I rarely say this about politicians, because believe me, I've been here long enough to know better. So far, it looks like he is just dead serious about doing this in as thorough and nonpartisan a fashion as is possible.
Well, and he is issuing subpoenas now, right?
Well, they have issued one subpoena to the Federal Aviation Administration. And this arose because of, it gets back to what I was talking about earlier in the program, the slow document production from the agencies. The FAA apparently on several occasions had told the commission that it had turned over everything, that you have it all, you've got all our documents, you've got all our tracking and so forth and so on. And then in the course of conducting interviews with real live human beings, in the air traffic system, the commission discovered, aha, what are these tapes you're talking about, and what are these tracking reports you're talking about? And they learned through subsequent interviews with people that there was more out there, and they demanded them through a subpoena. The FAA says, you know, you really didn't need to subpoena this. We just didn't know. We didn't turn them over. Something fairly lame. But, again, that is why the time element here is so important. To hear the commissioners tell it, some of them anyway, what's in some of this late-coming FAA material is absolutely crucial to know what happened that day. Because, you know, the failure that day, of course, was a long-term, the result of a long-term failure to grapple with the terrorist threat. But it also, on that morning, was just an abject failure to protect the country from attack. And the families are convinced that certainly the second plane should never have hit the second tower, and probably the Pentagon plane should not have hit the Pentagon, because there are time lapses involved in when the first plane took off and was discovered to be hijacked or off course, when the second plane took off, and so forth. So the families are very, very, very much interested in getting an accurate and complete timeline of what happened that morning with the planes. When did the FAA know that they were hijacked? When did the FAA alert the Pentagon? Was the Pentagon alerted? Why didn't NORAD, the North American Air Defense System that's supposed to be activated, why didn't they respond sooner than they did? One of the things that Governor Kaine has said, and I think it's really important, there's a lot of conspiracy theories that are floating around about the attack. Some of them really, really off the wall. And the only way to ever clear up the conspiracy theories, some of which involve, you know, questions like, why didn't the plane scramble? Why didn't we shoot them down? The only way to clear those up is to get the real information into the public domain. So the longer we go without it, the longer we have this sort of festering segment of society that thinks there has been some kind of conspiracy afoot, or that somebody fell down on the job. You know, and I honestly don't know what to make of some of these time lags and what to make of the failure to really defend ourselves militarily that morning. I don't know whether it was...
We were being hijacked and crashed for 3.5 hours.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's exactly right. And so the family members, we know, for example, that the Port Authority of New York, which ran those buildings, made a gross error when it told people to stay at some point, more than one point, actually. The PA system in the buildings was saying, don't leave, you're safe, you know, nobody should leave the North Tower, whichever tower, I forget. But there was a public announcement for people to stay where they were. Well, that was obviously a mistake. That was obviously a gross failure. But we've known about that for months. We've known about that practically since September 12th. In fact, I think we knew about it on September 11th as people did escape the towers and started telling people, other folks, reporters and camera crews and so forth, but the PA kept saying, stay put. So we know that the Port Authority failed, and they have taken, you know, there's all kinds of investigations and city council inquiries and state inquiries and all kinds of probing that's been done in New York about what could the Port Authority have done differently, why did the towers collapse, what kind of building code issues arise from this event. And the city and the state of New York have done a good bit to sort of expose where those problems were. We're still really waiting for the federal government to do the same.
Now, all the hardest questions about this are coming from the family members, but there's none of them on the commission itself, right? They only have their steering committee.
Well, they have their steering committee, and there's actually a family representative who works for the commission as sort of a gatekeeper who brings the family concerns to the commissioners. And I know I've
been in contact with a number of these family members, and they do have access. There are some commissioners that are, in fact, I haven't heard anyone really complain that the commissioners themselves are inaccessible, and I know that some of the family members have developed a relationship with a number of the commissioners. So I don't think that the family's problem right now is that they don't have access or that they don't have a voice. They are hotly angry at the delays. They are very angry that there's been no interim report, at least on some initial findings. Every interim report we have had so far basically consists of Governor Kane standing up saying, we're making progress, but we still aren't getting everything we need. And this is starting to disturb them. They feel as though it's 2 years since this attack, and they should have at least preliminary answers so far, and they don't.
In your most recent column, you said that the White House set the date to expire in May because they want to make sure that it's over long before election time.
That's correct. That was actually publicly, that was very upfront. When the legislation was being drafted and passed by the Congress, the White House was lobbying pretty heavily and pretty publicly to have the end date, as were the Republicans on the Hill, to have the end date so that it would be over and out and the report would be issued before we got into the heat of the political campaign. Now, the problem with extending the mandate, extending the time frame, there's a couple of problems with it. One is that it's unlikely to happen, frankly, with the Republicans in control of both houses of Congress and very much concerned with their own reelection in November. Their own seats are up. The president obviously is running for reelection, and his party controls both houses of the Congress. So I think it would be really something that's an uphill climb to convince the Congress to you'd have to pass new legislation that has a new date on it. The family members are convinced that if they want an extension and they come to the conclusion that it's absolutely necessary, that if they scream long and loud and publicly enough, who is going to deny this to them? Who could conceivably deny these widows and orphans a full account? I don't know exactly how that's going to play out. I do know that the danger with an extension is that the date for the release of a report would come after the November election, because of course that's another good political protection plan. Okay, you want an extension? Fine. You'll get your report by December 31st. So, you know, there's all kinds of tricks you can play with this date.
Yeah, and they're playing them. Okay, so I went to the website for the Independent Commission. I went through the list of questions that the family members were asking.
Yes.
And, boy, they asked some really tough questions here.
They do.
There are questions like, what is the name of the CIA agent who brought Osama bin Laden to the American hospital in Dubai in July of 2001? And I wonder, is there anybody on the commission that's seeking answers to those kind of questions? Or
I honestly don't know that. They're pretty close-mouthed. I doubt, look, we have separately from this an ongoing Justice Department investigation of the revelation of a CIA operative name, apparently by somebody in the Bush, well, certainly by somebody in the Bush administration, if not the White House, to the columnist Robert Novak. So nobody's going to reveal, the names of covert CIA operatives. That would be unlikely in any event. I think perhaps I know what the family members are getting at. What they're trying to show is a pattern of acquiescence on the part of the United States government with respect to bin Laden or the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, whatever. And so I think that becomes pertinent in that sense. But certainly you're never going to get the name of a CIA agent, and I'm not sure it's necessary to do that.
Right, well, and the point is not so much the name of the guy, but whether, in fact, it is true.
Whether it's true. But see, you know, this is what I want to point out again. There are a lot of rumors out there about who did what when, and what did the current president do, what did the former president do, what did Halliburton do. I mean, you named a pipeline. I mean, I'm sure you must have heard the conspiracy theories about the oil pipeline. So really, if there was no complicity or no looking the other way or no nothing to be embarrassed about and no nothing to really support any of these conspiracy theories, get the information out so that they can be laid to rest.
Well, and you know what the conspiracy theorists would say is, hey, and that's why they're still covering it up.
Yes, I've spoken like a true conspiracy theorist.
Oh, great, thank you. I mean, after all, Bin Laden at least was blamed by our government for the Africa embassy bombings and for the USS Cole, and if any CIA officer was meeting with him in the American hospital in Dubai in July and didn't arrest him immediately...
In July of 2001, frankly, I have to tell you on the face of it, I really would discount that. It just doesn't ring right to me.
Well, it doesn't ring right to me either, but I don't know whether it happened or not. If it did...
I don't either.
But anyways, I wanted to make the point about just really how tough the family's questions are compared to the kind of questions I'm seeing on TV. I mean, they're asking a lot of really tough stuff about, you know, tell me, you know, give us exactly the transcripts of the conversations between the F-16 pilots and the tower and that kind of thing. And I don't think that's the kind of thing that the government's ever going to release.
Well, I think in the case of that one, anything that went between FAA and the military, we need to know that, because we need to know whether we were defending ourselves properly. Why do we have this great military? You know, the purpose of the military is not just to fight wars overseas. That's what we're all used to, because that's what our life experience has been, thank God. But in fact, the purpose of the military is to defend our country. So you can't have a military and only expect it to perform abroad, wherever you send it abroad. They're supposed to perform at home as well.
I know I've already got my half an hour, so I'm going to give you a...
You've got your half an hour.
Closing statements, anything you want to finish up with?
Well, I just want to make one comment, really, about the importance of this commission. Probably a lot of the rest of the country has moved on from this. Certainly I can tell you that as somebody who works for a New York publication, the city of New York, everyone's back to work, everybody's back to business, everybody's pretty much back to normal. But you know, there's a hole in the city, and it's not just the physical hole of where Ground Zero was, and it's a hole in these families' lives, and we're constantly being told by the president and everyone else that we are still at risk. We are still under threat. We have a Homeland Security Department now that was created specifically because the government decided on a bipartisan and overwhelming basis that we are at great risk for future terrorist attack. And if we do not get a thorough and public assessment of the first big one, I don't see how we can ever fill in the holes that are necessary to be filled in to prevent a second one. And I think that's why the public should be interested in this commission. I frankly have always been stunned that the commission does not get more press coverage. There's relatively few reporters who go to these briefings. They tend to be the major newspapers and, frankly, regional papers from New York and New Jersey. And it shouldn't be. This was an attack on our country. There's a question in everyone's mind as to whether anything could have been done to prevent it. But certainly we're supposed to be looking now to prevent the next one. And we can't do that until we know what happened on that day.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, Mrs. Coco.
You're welcome.
Coco writes for Newsday. This is Radio Chaos, 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas.